You're tuned in to Katie and Kay. I'm Abby Gerke, filling in for Gavin Dahl, and this is Booked. Adrian Berger, welcome to Booked and to Katie and Kay. I really enjoyed reading the book Wild Game, so thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You have an event, and that's why you're in town this week at the Wheeler Opera House on Friday, correct?
That's correct.
At 5:30?
Yes.
Well, there are so many places I'd love to go with your book and with this interview, but first I'd love for you to read an excerpt from your book to start us off.
I'd be happy to. Just to give a little background for people who are being introduced to Wild Game for the first time, it's the story of my complicated relationship with my mother, Malabar, and it opens with what was a very pivotal moment in my life, perhaps the most pivotal. And that took place when I was 14 years old. The setting is Cape Cod. And just to sort of set the scene, my mother and stepfather had had weekend guests who were the Southers, who were my stepfather's oldest friends. And it is after midnight during the scene that I'm about to read. I'm asleep in my bedroom upstairs, and the door opens, and my mother has come in. The only other thing you need to know is that my nickname is Rennie. Wake up, Rennie. I felt a hand on my shoulder and pulled the sheet over my head. Rennie, please. Even before I turned and saw her face, I could hear a peculiar quaver in my mother's whisper and smell the remnants of the Pinot Noir. Her voice sounded hesitant and desperate. The mattress sank where she lowered herself beside me, and my body stiffened against the depression. I kept my eyes shut and steadied my exhalations. Rennie! The whisper, more urgent now, still held an unfamiliar tremor. She pulled down the sheet. Please, wake up. At this, I opened my eyes. Malabar was in her nightgown, her hair mussed. Mom, what's wrong? Is everything okay? Ben Souther just kissed me. I took in this information, tried to make sense of it, couldn't. I rubbed my eyes. My mother was still there beside me. Ben kissed me, my mother repeated. A noun, a verb, an object, such a simple sentence, really, and yet I couldn't comprehend it. Why would Ben Souther kiss my mother? It wasn't that I was naive. I knew that people kiss people they weren't supposed to. My parents had not shielded me from the stories of both their transgressions during their marriage, and in this way, I knew more about infidelity than most children. I was 4 when my parents broke up, 6 when my father remarried, 7 when that new marriage started to fall apart, and 8 when my mother was finally able to wed Charles, who'd been separated from but still married to his first wife when they met. Ben was married too, of course, to Lily. The Southers had been married for 35 years. Mom and Charles, Ben and Lily. The 4 of them had been couple friends for as long as my mother and stepfather had known each other, about a decade now. What do you mean Ben kissed you? Suddenly, I was fully awake. I pictured her slapping him in response. That was something my mother might do. What happened? We took a walk after dinner, just the 2 of us, and he pulled me into him like this. My mother crossed her arms around herself, simultaneously demonstrating Ben's caress and embracing its memory. Then she collapsed the rest of the way onto the bed, smiling, and stretched out alongside me. Apparently, there had been no slap. I still can't believe it. Ben Souther kissed me, she said. What was it about her voice tonight? He kissed me, Rennie. There it was again. Joy. A tone I hadn't heard from her since before Charles's strokes. Joy had fallen from the night sky and landed in my mother's voice. One kiss, the gleam and shine of it, what it might portend, had changed everything.
Thank you. So, wow. after this night, you write that there is a clear before and after in your life.
Yes.
Do you remember what you and your mother would talk about before this night or do together?
I mean, sure. In that way, I mean, the before was the world of childhood, and my mother was my mother. And, you know, we did all sorts of things. My mother was a surprisingly game woman. She was the life of the party. She was this astonishing cook. And so we did all sorts of stuff together, but it was very, our roles were clear up until that night. And it was as if, you know, I went to bed as her daughter and I woke up as her best friend and confidant. And I just had immediately our relationship morphed into almost the reverse, almost like I was more of the parent. I was giving advice, which is a little crazy, you know, your 14-year-old counsel. But it was also, you know, it was just such a role reversal. And when I think back on it, you know, when I think about it now, of course, at my age, and I happen to have a 14-year-old daughter of my own, I can imagine how readers feel the shock and the understanding of the burden that it put on me. At the time, at 14, I mean, it was very exciting. It was, you know, it was wonderful to be so important to my mother, to be sort of in the spotlight of her love and to have such a kind of important role in her drama. And so it was a very compelling and very seductive time of my life. So that was the after.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it, you know, broiled into something that was much more complicated and destructive over time.
Mm-hmm. What do you think led your mother to confiding in you rather than calling a friend or even your brother? Peter,
right,
in the story?
You know, that is the million-dollar question, of course, and it's one I've never gotten a tremendously satisfying answer from her, so I'm guessing here. But I think part of it was, you know, she had blurred boundaries. I think she thought we were very close, which we were very close, and I don't think she thought it was particularly wrong. I mean, there's that, too, and I think that goes back to the fact that there's a legacy of secret keeping and deception in my family. I mean, her parents were married and divorced and married and divorced from each other. And she'd found out that her father had a secret family. You know, her mother also had affairs. So I think in that way that everyone's childhood is normal, I think it was probably part of her childhood. So it didn't seem that unusual. It became part of mine. I also think it was a really impulsive move on her part. I think she'd probably had a lot to drink. There was a lot of drinking going on at these parties and these events of my mother's, and actually just sort of on a daily basis, you know, with these lavish meals came, you know, a lot of booze mm-hmm. and wine. And so I think it probably happened. She wanted something immediate. She's not going to call someone at midnight. And there I was. And, you know, the darker thing is she probably, you know, I don't imagine this was conscious on her part, but I think she understood that I would have done anything for her and I was in her thrall and would want to help and was probably easily manipulated.
Mm-hmm. So you talk about the legacy in your family of secrets, and families have secrets. What sets you apart is your writing. Your writing is so brave, and it really captures the reader. And it's written in such a unique way. You talk about your feelings of guilt, your role in your mother's affair, and how you wanted your mom to be happy. I became so captivated in your writing and the dinner parties and the way you wrote about writing and the way you wrote about your mother that you almost forget the narcissistic ways that your mother is being toward you and the toll it's taking on you. But then you come back to the fact that this is actually happening and this is real. So I guess my question for you is, did writing this memoir in a way help you to begin to forgive her?
Wow. First of all, thank you for everything you said about the writing. And it was really complicated to write. And I think one of the things that I enjoyed most or tried to get across most was the all the gray area of it, because I feel like, you know, we like to put things in our their places, and we like things that are black and white, and, you know, this is bad and this is good and so on. And I, the fact is, you can have a parent who fails you and also still adore that parent. And also there's good and bad with it. And I was really determined to show the relationship in all its complexities. And yeah, she did have some terrible failures. Your actual question in the end was about forgiveness. Is that right? Okay. I'm just, I feel like the interesting thing in writing this memoir was forgiving my mother took a backseat to understanding her. And it was really fascinating, the process, when I realized I had to sort of loosen the grip on my own narrative and put myself in her shoes and really try to understand her life. It became a path towards empathy and forgiveness. And by what I mean by that is, you know, she had tragedies in her life that I, you know, that can pain me even to read about. So aside from, you know, her parents' miserable marriage, her alcoholic mother, I think both of her parents were narcissists. She went on to have an unhappy first marriage to my father. She lost her first child. You know, these really Herculean events to overcome. And even my stepfather, my first stepfather, who I believe was the great love of her life, you know, he had 4 strokes in 5 days just before they were getting married. So, mm-hmm. you know, some people can look at my mother and think, you know, wow, she did these terrible things. And other people look at her and think, wow, she was a feminist before her time. You know, she's a survivor. She's going to go for love and put herself forward. And, you know, so there are a whole bunch of different ways of looking at her. I'm not sure if I've really answered your question about forgiveness, but yes, I have forgiven my mother. Writing the book was part of it, living through it, having 40 years to process mm-hmm. these events. And also the fact that, you know, my mother's very ill right now. We're in an entirely different place in our relationship. And it just, it's almost not even really something that's part of my thinking right now, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense. Thank you. Your mother, Malabar, even in her name is such a bold name. And in the story, I found myself realizing that you used the name Malabar a lot more than mom or mother. Was that on accident or was that on purpose?
You know, that's such an interesting point. And a few people have made it. And I now need to go back and actually look at the number of times, because I feel like it was sort of 50-50, you know, and part of it was as practical as saying my mother, mom, you know, all the time mm-hmm. just got boring. And she does, by the way, have such a fabulous name. But I think it actually stands out more just because of the name. I mean, I never called her Malabar in life, which I think some people assume. But in all the dialogue and a lot of the description, she's my mother, and I only ever called her mom. Mm-hmm. But it is a forceful name. I mean, I think I wrote in the book, but I always used to wonder about this. Is like, would Malabar be Malabar if she were like Susie?
Right.
Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. You do wonder that.
And there was no one who shortened her name as far as I know. I mean, I remember her father, my grandfather, calling her Mabby a few times, but like husbands, Malabar, friends, Malabar. There was no, you know, mm-hmm. little adorable nickname there.
Yeah. And she's determined, like I said, and very persistent. Do you find that that's a quality, the persistence and determination that you got from her in a positive way?
I hope so. I mean, you know, we all have such huge flaws and huge graces, right? And if you can use any of these inherited qualities that have both bad and good sides for good, I think it's only a positive thing. But yes, I think on some level, you could never tell my mother there was something she couldn't do. If she set her eyes on something, she would accomplish it. I don't feel like I have quite that level of, I'm not sure. But, you know, she did give me courage in ways that I'm sure I wouldn't have had without her. For instance, I had been in an entirely different field in my younger life, and I graduated, you know, with an eye towards going into public policy and politics, which is my first sort of career move. And I got a master's in public policy. And then I just realized, with a lot of help from other people, but that literature was really where I wanted to be. And I am not sure that I would have had whatever it took to start a literary magazine if I hadn't just sort of seen my mother do those types of things without even mm-hmm. recognizing that these were courageous acts on her part.
Mm-hmm. For those of you just tuning in, this is Booked on KDNK. I'm Abby Gerke, filling in for Gavin, and my guest is Aspen Words Executive Director Adrienne Brodeur, talking about her new memoir, Wild Game. You talk about the reason why you had a career change, and you mentioned a little bit about other people having an influence, and I found that in this book, connection was a big theme and relationships, mm-hmm. and I was so interested in Margot,
yeah.
Your father's third wife. Your father's third wife. Obviously, the book had been mostly about your connection with your mother, Malabar, but Margot had a huge impact.
She did.
In your life. You write about her in such a lovely way, and I wanted to learn more about her.
Margot was an extraordinary person in my life, and oddly, you know, at the same time that I had moved out to California, my father had also fallen in love and moved to California, and we were both in San Diego. What were the chances? And Margot ran a beautiful independent bookstore in Del Mar, and from the very first time I met her, before she and my dad were married, I remember her pressing these incredible novels into my hands. And really, she made me a reader. I mean, I had read in the way that any, you know, well-educated person had read. And I, you know, I didn't dislike reading, but I hadn't fallen in love with it. I wasn't one of the kids with the flashlight under the blanket. And then Margot came into my life. And I think she intuited the trouble I was in probably before even I had. And she, when she started giving me these books, I still remember the first packet of books, which included Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God, Jim Harrison's Dalva, and one of Barbara Kingsolver's early books, either Animal Dreams or The Bean Trees. And all of these books, these novels, featured young female protagonists kind of getting their, clawing their way out of some fix. And you know, this just dovetails into all my work at Aspen Words and elsewhere, but, you know, how literature can show you paths. It's such a deeply empathetic act to read, to immerse yourself in someone else's life, to get out of your own head and bubble and see the world from other perspectives, whether that's, you know, in a war zone or in the Deep South or, you know, just wherever. And I found it so inspiring to read and to imagine how to sort through my own stuff. So, I mean, it was reading, it was therapy, and it was friendships that really helped me reclaim my life ultimately.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever confide in Margot about your mother's affair?
Well, not until it had already come out, but once everything had come out, it actually gave me the freedom to talk to a lot of people. And that was essential because I think you mentioned the sort of legacy of secret keeping. I mean, I think the most difficult part, the worst part of keeping a secret of the magnitude that I kept is, you know, it keeps you from being known. I think Carl Jung called secrets, I might get this wrong, but psychic poison, and how they alienate the secret keeper from his or her community. And that was so true for me because you can't actually have close friendships, a romantic relationship, a relationship with a teacher, whatever it is, if you are holding a huge part of yourself back from that relationship. And I didn't realize that that was, you know, happening until suddenly the secret was out and I was able to, you know, confess my feelings about it, the shame I felt for deceiving people and the hurt that I had caused. So it was really a big change.
Mm-hmm. Another relationship that you had was Kyra.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a person that was really upfront with you, it seemed like, in your book. and asked you the question of, was your life authentically your own?
Right.
And that really stuck with me. Are you still close with her?
Yes, I am. She's my, has been my best friend for a million years. We met as waitresses on Cape Cod. And she always, she just always gave it to me straight. And the other thing is, you know, when you trust someone as much as I trusted Kara, she would say things that I would think about. I mean, she was the first person who pointed out my mother's loneliness to me. I mean, it had never occurred to me that my mother might be a lonely person. And when she made that point, it actually changed the way I saw her and understood her, and continues to this day. Yeah.
Yeah, she seems like such a great friend. I want to backtrack a little bit to your family. Mm-hmm. And I have siblings of my own, and we have great relationships, but it always ebbs and flows. And throughout the book, I always was thinking about your brother, Peter. I loved the way that you wrote about the scene. It was almost a utopian scene of him with his partner at the time riding off into the sunset, and you seemed like you were almost jealous of him, and then the boat that he was on, his beloved boat, turns around, and the name of his boat was Malabar. And then it was clear that you even mentioned that you had both allegiances to your mother and not to each other. So I wondered the whole time, what was your relationship, or how is your relationship with your brother now?
Well, how it is now is how it's always been, which is not great. We're not close. And I think it probably doesn't come as a surprise, because there were always secrets in our family. I mean, you know, I think people read a memoir and think, I know the whole story. And of course, this is a memoir about one secret and one relationship. But as many as I had, I know, I'm sure my brother had others with my mother. And the long story short is, it doesn't create an open and trusting relationship between two people. So I think my brother and I mean, I don't want to speak for him. Mm-hmm. I think we love and respect each other. We keep a distance from each other. And what I can say, though, that I feel very good about is that both of us seem to have found our way. He, you know, we're both sort of successful in our different professions. We both, how on the earth this happened, I do not know, but we have both married very emotionally intelligent partners and people. And the best thing of all is that our children are great friends. They are as close as cousins can be. And I feel like, for whatever failings have happened in our generation, we seem determined not to pass it along to the next. So I feel good about that.
Mm-hmm. And does your daughter, you talk about your daughter and your brother's kids, do they have a relationship with Malabar?
Yes. My daughter is very close to my mother. You know, she's the oldest grandchild, so she just had more years with her, and they have a very special bond. But also my son and their cousin, I mean, my mother's house is located between our two houses, so a lot of times they have a meeting place there. And in fact, they've turned my mother's garage into their little fort now that she doesn't drive. But they meet on a rock on the beach between the houses that they call Cousins Rock. They're like the Three Musketeers, and they have been since they were little.
That's great.
Yeah.
Earlier you mentioned the psychologist Carl Jung.
Mm-hmm.
He said something like, I think it goes, the greatest burden a child must bear is that of its parents' unlived life. And
wow. Yes, indeed.
Clearly, this memoir is about you living part of your mother's life. But I wondered, I wonder again about the legacy and the secrets of your family. And I wonder about your mother's childhood growing up. And you mentioned that she did have, your grandmother had a really difficult life as well.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, in your writing, if anything, when you were writing, came out in your memoir that surprised you, or that you hadn't known before about your mother or your grandmother?
Well, a lot came out that I hadn't known about both of them. you know, I talked to my mother about wanting to write this book probably about 5 years ago and telling her that I wanted to write it, that I felt the need to write it and need to write it directly in memoir as opposed to fiction. Hmm. And I have to say, I'll always feel grateful that she gave me her support in it. I mean, I don't,
sure.
Which is different from being excited and thrilled, but she did give me access to a lot of personal documents of hers, old scrapbooks, you know, just an array of treasures. And she was a big chronicler of her own life. The biggest thing that I hadn't known before writing the memoir that my mother disclosed to me was that my grandmother had practically the same affair. She wasn't married at the time. She and my grandfather had long been divorced, but she met a man who was married to an unhealthy woman, and they had an extramarital affair for years until this woman died. And the man actually came from the same town as Ben Souther. Like, they are both from Plymouth. It boggled my mind to learn that. I feel like intuitively I understood that there were generations of deception going on, that it wasn't just something that my mother had introduced. But actually going back and in memoir, you find out that things you thought were true are true, and it is tremendously satisfying. I mean, that sounds strange. One thing, this is sort of spinning off in another direction. Mm-hmm. My daughter and I, my family moved to Massachusetts really recently, and while we were looking at schools for my daughter, we visited my old school where she applied to, where I went to high school. And as we were in the, you know, admissions office, she said, "Oh, Mom, let's find your yearbook." And this was after I had turned the book in. And I remember thinking, wow, this is interesting. I haven't seen that yearbook in years. And I was only at the school 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, which were the years, I mean, 10. I was entering that school the fall following the summer that I discovered the affair. And all of a sudden, I had this panic of like, did I remember everything right? And then she presents me with the yearbook, and we flip through, and I am not in the yearbook other than my one page. And just the day before, we'd been looking at where I'd gone to elementary school because we applied there for my son. And I am all over that yearbook. I am, you know, on these sports teams and I'm in the drama and club and this and that. And I just, my life turned entirely away from school and toward my mother. So it's those little moments of sort of, I don't know if it's fact finding or just, you know, kind of confirmation of what you believe and you thought you researched, but it's always nice to find out about it from another angle.
Yeah. And so your daughter's 14 now?
My daughter's 14 now.
And how old is your son?
He's 11.
And so along the same lines as living your parents' unlived life, do you ever wonder what part of your unlived life that your kids might be living?
Okay, that's too meta. I have not thought about that. I mean, I have so singularly been focused on not sort of repeating the same mistakes. I'm sure I'm introducing new ones and, you know, really right. Only time will tell on any of that front of what part of my unlived life they might be living. I think it's probably just wishful thinking. I really think that they are having such a different childhood than I ever had, just in having sort of stable parents who are mm-hmm. together and happy. And, you know, we're very family focused. I mean, mm-hmm. we have, you know, I never had family dinners with my parents. That was the cocktail hour. And, you know, we get together pretty much every night that we're all home mm-hmm. and sit down and, you know, rehash our days and stuff like that. I mean, it all sounds very basic, but it's really different from how I grew up.
And has your daughter read your book?
This is sort of a funny story, but over the summer before the book came out, I came out of my bedroom one morning to see her sort of splashed in sunlight on the living room sofa with the galley in hand. And I told her the story of the book, so, you know, she wasn't going to be shocked, because it occurred to me that she was of age to handle this book. And I came out and I sort of saw her and I was like, whoa, this is happening. And this might be just how I'm trying to spin it, but she didn't finish, which is fine. All of a sudden, I thought afterwards, I was like, high five to myself, because I was so obsessed with my mother's interior life at her age. And I feel overjoyed that she's not, you know, it could be just I wrote a boring book. But I actually prefer to think, you know, she's a reader who loves world building fiction. She's a Rick Riordan fan. She loves Greek mythology. I mean, this is probably such a big snooze to her. But also she just has, you know, a vibrant little social life of her own. And she plays sports and she's at a new school and she's making friends. And it seems like a fine thing to me.
That's great.
Yeah.
So if someone were her age or 14 now or around this age and they were going through something similar or family struggles, what would you say to them?
You know, people, this is a different twist on a question that I've been asked before, is which is kind of what would you say to yourself? And it's hard to know, because honestly, you sort of have to go, I mean, we all go through something.
Right.
This sounds unusual, but one of the things since this book has been out in the world that's been so surprising to me is just how many people relate to it. So even if you weren't your wingman for your mother's extramarital affair, you can still relate. Mothers have a very powerful role. Sometimes they cross boundaries. It's a blurry line. Like, I know that with my own daughter. She's, you know, she looks all parts woman and she's graceful and mature and everything else. And so, you know, I don't have anything big to confide in her, but sometimes you're talking and it's so open and warm and wonderful. And then you also remember she's a child. Mm-hmm. So I think the lesson that I wish I'd learned sooner is just the importance of, you know, that old saying, to thine own self be true, knowing yourself, valuing yourself, knowing your strengths and weaknesses, but really setting your own boundaries on some level.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that you know that until you know it.
Right.
I'm still learning.
Me too.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that you brought up the fact that on your book tour, since this book has come out, that you've been so surprised at people that have connected, that can relate to the book. And I feel the same way, even though I can't directly relate to what you had to go through or what you are going through. It just was amazing how you start to think about the relationships in your life and you start to go down each avenue, and it was really nice.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. We didn't really get to talk about food, but food and alcohol seemed to play a really important role in your life.
It sure did. We went from meal to meal in my house, and they were all wonderful. And you know, it is one of the things I'm very grateful to my mother for, because I love to cook. I love putting, you know, healthy food on the table for my children, my family. And you know, it was really, you know, I know a lot of men and women who find cooking this enormous chore and this taxing thing. And, you know, you'd rather just sort of get the completed deal from Whole Foods. And for me, it's, you know, cleaning is a chore. A lot of domestic stuff is a chore. But cooking actually feels creative. It feels stress reducing, like chopping those onions when you get home after a bad day. I don't know. I enjoy it fully.
Do you have a Malabar recipe that you like to use?
Oh, I have a lot of her recipes that I use all the time. You know, I mean, I think we probably all have our rotating list and then we go out and try different things. But I'm not as nearly as good a chef as she was. I mean, she was one of those people who really could be at a restaurant, dip her pinky into some sauce, you know, taste the completely behind the scenes ingredient, identify it, and then replicate the sauce. Like, none of that is within my repertoire. I enjoy cooking. I'm a good cook, but that's sort of where I'd stop with it.
Do you have dinner parties?
I do. I mean, I haven't, you know, more before I had children, some now. The nicest part about getting older and having dinner parties is being less of a perfectionist. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love having friends over. I love conversation. I'm more of a, it won't surprise you, intimacy person than a big party, you know, say hi to everyone. I love having, you know, four or six people over just around the table breaking bread together. But no, I mean, it's been the past few years between writing the book, between my job at Espen Words, between, mm-hmm. you know, growing children and aging parents, I have not been throwing lots of dinner parties.
If you could throw a dinner party, what people would be at your table?
Oh, you know, if you're asking for celebrities, no one. I mean, I love being with friends. I love being with like-minded people and unlike-minded people. But I really enjoy anyone who wants to have sort of deep conversation. And that sounds very lofty. But, I am not interested in the weather and traffic and so on. I really, you know, we're all trying to figure out how to be humans and how to get through this life and all the complexities of it. And those are the conversations I love to have.
Mm-hmm. Now that you're dealing with your past in such a constructive way, how do you think this will inform the rest of your life?
You're asking a lot of small questions. I'm not sure how to answer that. I mean, it's been an incredible experience to have written this book, to feel like I got down what I wanted to say as I wanted to say it. You know, I think we all have important stories to tell, and I had no idea how satisfying it would be to tell mine the way I wanted it to be told. And, you know, it's likely to go on to be a film, which will be great. That's going to be someone else's version of it. The other thing that's been really odd and exciting and an adjustment is realizing that the book that I know I wrote is not necessarily the book that you read. And this is new for me. This is really a new understanding that every reader reads a different book and everyone has a different lens. And I will have people tell me what my book is about that simply stuns me, but it's my book through their lens. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of cool.
That is cool. And you're the executive director for Espen Words.
I am. And it is a fantastic organization. And I just have to say that I feel like, you know, if for 1 minute I can talk about it as an mm-hmm. author and not the director, I feel like I benefited extraordinarily as an author in witnessing our programs. Because as an editor, I always used to see writers' most polished work. And in my role at Espen Words, I have seen writers, I mean, of every variety, like the emerging writers who come through Summer Words, the writers who get to experience our incredible residency program that we do with the Cato Shaw Family Foundation, you know, writers coming to speak at Winter Words, but also just writers in this community who, you know, throughout the Roaring Fork Valley, people who have had these incredibly accomplished careers, but who are suddenly like in the most vulnerable, skinless state of putting their work out there. And that was new for me. And I swear, I do not think I would have had the courage to write this book had I not been lucky enough to get this job and be exposed to this community. Because it gave me, you know, if everyone else could do this and be as vulnerable as they were being, it gave me courage to do it too. So I feel very indebted.
And so you have an event at the Wheeler Friday at 5:30.
Yes, please come.
All right. Thanks so much for being here, Adrian. And I look forward to buying your book as gifts this holiday season.
Thanks so much.